Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to World Weekly with me, Gideon Rachman. This week, we concentrate on Egypt. Last weekend, the country staged presidential elections, an event that was meant to be a crowning moment in Egypt's transition to democracy. But the announcement of the winner has been delayed a few days, with the two candidates, Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood and Ahmed Shafik, a former prime minister under the old regime of Hosni Mubarak, both claiming victory. Meanwhile, the ruling transitional military councils announced a series of dramatic measures, including the dissolution of a democratically elected parliament, as well as a decree giving the military sovereignty over the military budget, legislative power, and the veto rights over future constitutional proposals. Some are calling this a coup that's rolled back the gains of the Egyptian revolution. So what are we to make of it all? Joining me on the line is David Gardner, our international affairs editor, and on the line from Cairo is Borju Daragachi, our correspondent there. Borju, if I can go to you first. Would you go as far as calling this a counter-revolution?
Well, it does seem like there are some counter-revolutionary elements to what has happened. I think that the complication is that ever since the uprising last year, the military has been in charge, technically, politically, legally. And so it's hard to call it a coup or a counter-revolution so much as a consolidation of the military's already a considerable power. This was not a full-on revolution, as we saw, for example, in Libya, where the old regime was just completely wiped away. This was a managed revolution with the military retaining the upper hand throughout.
But I guess the feeling was that this was perhaps a transitional arrangement and that the military was holding the ring until you move to a fully fledged democracy. And now it looks like the military has no intention of getting out of the ring.
Well, according to many people here, the military never had any intention of getting out of the ring. That they had reserved for themselves certain rights that they have never really intended to give up. And that if you had watched them closely rather than listening to their words, you would have figured that out.
David, can I bring you in here? What do you make of this? I mean, particularly the dissolution of parliament sounds an incredibly dramatic measure.
Yeah, I mean, I think the postponement looks ominously like the same sort of procedural ruse as they used in the dissolution of parliament. I mean, bear in mind that in both cases, the Muslim Brotherhood was among the organizations that raised legal objections. So there is a slightly alarming similarity to that. But having said that, I think until this postponement, at least as of Tuesday, I think the generals and the SCAF and so on did look set to allow a Morsi victory through. And given the stakes, I think it would be smart for them still to do that. I mean, if you look, if you give even a cursory glance to the scale of the challenges ahead, the need to put the country back on its feet, restore security, reboot the economy, restart a flow of investment and so on, you're looking at a long period of wrenching change, of dislocation and possible turmoil. Do they really want to take all the responsibility for this alone? Or would it be smarter to lay off some of this responsibility onto the Muslim Brotherhood qua president, open the field for them to be held accountable for the first time, in a sense to dirty them up a bit? We don't know, it seems to me, whether they are that smart. The past 16 months, when, as Borju said, they have essentially been in charge, they have avoided any decisions about the direction of the country and preferred essentially to safeguard their own interests. But we do know as a result of that that they have a very lively sense of their own interests. So let's see which way they jump.
Borju, give us a sense of how the Muslim Brotherhood are viewing this. Are they very alarmed? And also, I was told that there was a sense that the Muslim Brotherhood had not exactly covered themselves in glory during the period in which they've had the majority in Parliament.
Indeed. I would say right now that the Muslim Brotherhood is very nervous. They're just very, very on edge about what's going to happen next and what decision they'll be confronted with. The ball will be in their court should, for example, this panel of judges rule that the election was won by their opponent because of what many would call dirty tricks on the part of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is the sort of scenario that some people are talking about. But, you know, indeed, the Muslim Brotherhood has not behaved in a way that would endear itself to many sectors of the Egyptian society. It started from the very beginning after the revolution when they sided with the military in approving a referendum that called for quick elections for parliament, that also institutionalized many of the problems that we see now. The Muslim Brotherhood was in favor of that, whereas many of the liberals and leftists in this country were against it. The sort of constitutional declaration passed with resounding support. And then later, during parliamentary elections, they originally promised not to contest a lot of seats for parliament, but somehow they did. And that upset a lot of people. It suggested that they were more interested in consolidating their power rather than adhering to the principles of the revolution. And the big thing was, of course, they had promised not to field a presidential candidate, and then they did, perhaps more for reasons of competing against other Islamists than other segments of the Egyptian political body. But in any case, they reneged on that promise, and that upset a lot of people.
Now, David, as you say, a lot of people have wanted to see, well, how would the Muslim Brotherhood perform in power? They've only had a little taste of it so far with this Islamist majority in the parliament. What's your sense of how they have been performing?
Well, I repeat what Bouzou was saying. I mean, the broken promises, the unreliability, the secretiveness and so on. But I mean, the performance in Parliament has been dismal. I mean, seldom has it been less than a disappointment, and quite often it's been an outright disgrace. With that, to be fair, limited but important platform, they've done next to nothing. The signalling has been mixed, the obsessing about the status of women in society and so on and so forth, and failure to engage with the problems of everyday life for the vast majority of Egyptians, and the stunning irrelevance of so much of their performance really has been dismal. But they still really haven't had the opportunity to perform, to move on from these sonorous but ultimately rather empty slogans such as Islam is the solution, or to give any indication, although Morsi in one of his recent speeches did sound as though he was moving towards, how can I put it, the sort of Erdogan, the Turkish view of the world, towards that sort of neo-Islamism, which does realize that it has to perform. But we really haven't seen anything, and the partial performance that we have seen, as I said, has been pretty dismal.
Bouzou, just can you clear something up for us? I mean, the dissolution of Parliament sounds an incredibly drastic step, like a sort of rollback of democracy. Is it that bad?
To many people, it's not a great step. It's not a great development. Many people in society, many people, liberals, leftists, even some former Muslim Brotherhood supporters, were not so unhappy with the decision. But if you talk to people who are more astute and distanced observers of the Egyptian political scene, it was not a good step to have this panel of judges make this ruling on a technicality. It should be said, however, that the sort of technicality that this ruling was based on is something, once again, that the Muslim Brotherhood agreed to in the first place. And the powers that the army has to dissolve parliament and so on. Again, it was something that the Muslim Brotherhood had agreed to in the first place. So in a way, they dug their own grave on this.
But will there'll be new elections at some point, I would guess. But people are talking about the reassertion of something called an Egyptian deep state. Do you think that deep state might be more important than any new elections?
You know, it's obvious in talking to people in the judiciary and in other institutions in this country that they are very worried and concerned about what would happen under a Muslim Brotherhood-led political administration. They fear for their jobs. They fear for ideological purges taking place here, as has happened in other revolutions and has happened to some extent, for example, in Tunisia or Libya. And so they have begun to sort of fight back. And one of the ways they've done that is through the courts. This is something we've seen in Turkey as well, which is where the term deep state originated.
And meanwhile, of course, the Egyptian economy is deteriorating, Borju. How bad is the situation on the ground?
Well, it is pretty bad. You know, there are some advantages, actually, because it seems like traffic and pollution are down. But if you think about the reasons for that, it's rather ominous. People have less to do. There's less business taking place. Many commercial transactions are being delayed after the elections, everyone says, regarding everything. Something like real estate transactions are down to zero because no one is quite certain what a fair market value would be for anything. And then meanwhile, this sort of really ominous development, the country's foreign currency reserves are declining, and there's a very good chance that they're going to have to make a more drastic than usual currency reevaluation that could even further hurt the country's position in the global economy.
Finally, David, if I can finish with you, we've always said that, you know, Egypt's the key to the whole region. It's the biggest country. It's a cultural center. It was the second to have a revolution. How far do events there and the kind of confusion that's emerging affect the regional picture in the Arab Spring as a whole?
The oft-cited leading political and cultural role of Egypt was very substantially degraded under the Mubarak dispensation. So, I mean, I think one needs to get that into perspective. But there is no getting away from the fact that if it were seen to be the case that Egypt can't do it, then the prospects of the other Arab countries hauling themselves out of the pit of despotism would look considerably less clear, very dim indeed. Going back to your question about the consequences of the dissolution of parliament, it is conceivable in a benign-ish scenario that given that one of the problems with the Egyptian transition, the very odd sequencing, I mean, normally, for example, you would go to some form of constituent assembly and establish the rules of the game. And, you know, here we are, we've had a parliamentary election, a presidential election, total confusion, and there's no constitution, no rules of the game. So if they were now to be able to go back and get the sequencing in a slightly more logical order, leading to clear rules established, the election of a new parliament and so on, that would be promising. But one of the things that in the flurry of decrees, which seems to me extremely ominous, is essentially the reintroduction of emergency law, martial law, through the back door after it had been left to expire by the parliament at the end of May. Now, that is extremely ominous. The regrouping and reconstruction of the institutions of repression, essentially, like state security, the Amin al-Dawla, all that is very ominous indeed. So there's the potentially benign and the already looking ominous here. And which way that goes is clearly going to radiate throughout the region too and send signals to other people and other leaders about where this is all going.
So a very delicately poised situation, both in Egypt and around the region. David Gardner, thank you very much indeed. Thanks also to Borju Daragaki in Cairo and to the team in the studio here in London. Until next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.